Fifth Avenue, Miami. I just had a memo, plant roots.
I'm telling myself because I need to be held accountable. And just because I move away from the people that hold me accountable the most, yeah, I need to have people that know what I'm capable of. Because over the last 5.5 years, through the program Alcoholics Anonymous, I've begun to become capable of. And I know one thing's for sure, this thing's out to get me. You know, my problem isn't so much the drinking as it is my living and my thinking, you know. But what I'd like to begin with sharing with you, my sobriety date is 5-12-03. By God's grace and His mercy, the program of AA, I can tell you right now that it's a beautiful day to be sober. I'm excited today. And I couldn't even tell you why. I think maybe just for the fact that I'm clean and sober and above ground and breathing. It's been an amazing day. It's been an amazing week. And before I talk about that a little bit, I'll tell you kind of how I got here. You know, I pieced most of this together by what people had told me of the event and kind of what I recall, which isn't a lot. But it was Halloween, I was 12 years old, and I experienced my first blackout. In and out of consciousness here and there. And I can tell you, I remember how it started. Don't so much remember the in-between. I remember how it finished it. You know, and it started with a bottle of Captain Morgan's rum. You know, fresh from Pop's liquor locker, you know, which wasn't much of a locker because I could, you know, get into it. And I remember very clearly the one thing that I have no problem remembering is what it felt like when I took that first pull off that bottle. You know, 12 years old, it made me warm inside. And it made all the coldness of the world around me vanish. And probably for the first time that I could recall, even at that young age, I felt comfortable in my own skin. Or actually, I should say I didn't care about being comfortable or uncomfortable in my skin. I do remember coming to after a significant number of hours that I can't recall on my parents' lawn, on their front lawn, really sick. And for some reason, I don't know, maybe it was just something I was born with, when I stumbled up to the door to go in and rang the doorbell and they came and answered it, I knew I was in trouble. So the first thing that I was able to say would come out of my mouth was, I think I've been poisoned. You know, because we always talk about on Halloween how there's always something in the candy that you get from the stranger and the loner in the house down the street. You're not supposed to go there, you know, and get your funky candy or whatever. So I'm at the door and I'm like, I'm poisoned. Well, Pops takes one look at me and he says, nah, you're drunk. Does the whole deal, you know, puts me in the shower, tries to sober me up, you know. The next morning, you know, he's standing over me with the cap that he found in my pocket, kind of using it like smelling salts. You know, like, here, how's that smell, boy? You know, kind of stuff like that. And I'm, you know, dry heaving and all that wonderful stuff. And none of that compared to the memory of how that made me feel. It made me feel good the time before. I grew up an only child in this family and I guess decent upbringing. And all my heroes became people that played guitar or they were in bands. And always feeling like an outsider, that gave me kind of an in. Because it was cool to do that. It was all right to do that, you know. And from an early age I started playing music and getting into bands And a funny thing came along with that was the lifestyle. Lots of drinking. And I was hanging out with older people. I was in bands, you know, with individuals that were definitely of age. And I quickly was educated how to drink. Not that I needed much help, but it was really enabling. And I continued that for a long time. Ended up, you know, dropping out of high school, moving around from place to place real early. And all I really can recall or think about was I was just running. Didn't know from what, but I was just running. You know, and when I think, when I, you know, as I was told, the history, and whether it's hereditary in the genes or learned or modeled, whatever. As I've learned the history of my family, you know, my grandfather died of cirrhosis, you know, in his 40s. My whole side of my dad's family, you know, you cut the family tree and it bleeds, you know, straight with you. You don't know what's happening. And it's like, I should have known, you know, doomed from the womb, you know, kind of thing. And I do remember my mom's sharing a story with me. When I was a baby, they would take me to parties and stuff, and this one family that they would, or this one couple they hang out with, had a dog, and I was obviously too old to remember this, but this is what was told to me, is, you know, I had my pacifier, right? And it would fall on the ground. And of course, you know, dogs got germs, you know, they want to clean it up, so they dip it in a little bit of wine, give it back to me. Well, I sucked all the wine off and spit it back out, you know, and they weren't seeing if there was a little pattern here or something, you know. And I always thought that was some funny thing. I was just like, excuse me, I was like, man, must have known something. Either that or I must have known, you know, not known anything at all or something. So, you know, I got through the teenage years, and I was in my 20s, and, you know, I am an alcoholic, but I smoked the hell out of some outside issues when I was out there. You know, and all this stuff continued, you know, through my life, and the one common denominator in all of it was I was running. I didn't want to stop for nothing. And I was invited to leave a few counties and a couple towns, and you know, it was just part of the journey to get from there to here. And around about way in my mid-20s, the county of Sonoma asked that I not come back. And I ended up in Hanford, California. Definitely on a mission to trade one for the other. That was, you know, that's how it worked. You know, and still though, you know, alcohol was, again, it was like the common denominator, you know. And I ended up in Hanford, California, you know, and for the next 9 years, something like that, close to, you know, it was like oblivion. I was just lost. I was just lost, and I could recount parts of the drunk log, but I don't think I need to. And what happened was some wonderful neighbors of mine called the Hanford PD on me. Because they were concerned. You know, I was living in North Hanford, and they were concerned that their community, their little neighborhood, you know, was not as safe as they would like it to be with me living there, you know, living with my parents. It might have been the traffic, you know, wandering around. It might have been me going in and out of my bedroom window, because I wasn't exactly like presenting myself to my parents at the time, so I would go in and out of my bedroom window, you know, thinking that I was real slick. You know, my neighbor would call up and leave messages on the answering machine, you know, saying, you know, Mrs. Jones, you know, there's a strange person coming and going, you know, by the bedroom window. You know, my mom must have been mortified, you know. My God, what are they thinking, you know? And so this neighbor calls the house on me, and they show up, and I began the next 3-year journey of what I consider to be my higher power's intervention. Now at the time, knowing who it was, you know, my thinking was that I was angry, you know, how dare they, until they got into my business, I should go blow their house up, you know, just for, yeah. Thankfully today, you know, I think it was one of the greatest things that could ever happen to me, you know, and I'm grateful that that happened, because it began this process, you know, began this process of finding higher powers, the first one being, you know, the Hanford PD, the second being the probation department, the third and final one at that time being the judge, you know, and I went through this process, and I went through this never-ending, obscene process of going in and out of county jail, going in front of the judge time and time again, and repeating the same thing over and over, going exactly back to where I was. And along the way, there were these signs and these people that were put in my life, besides the law enforcement, that were like, would tell me these things that would speak to my heart. And I didn't even know it at the time, but I was hearing the language of the heart. You know, the stuff that we hear in meetings and in the fellowship. because it spoke right to me, but I couldn't do anything about it. It was like I was standing back watching this happen, and there was nothing I could do about it. And I remember one of the first things that really hit me was my lawyer, when he visited me in the county one time, I was being real smart with him because, you know, it's like, it was my disease. It was in control, completely. And he'd ask me questions, I'd be real smart to him. And, you know, and so he'd be back, you know, he'd get back to me and say, you know, you're not taking this very seriously. You know, I became offended when he said that, you know. And he said to me, when he said that to me, I said, you don't think I can do this, do you? Just to be an ass, you know, just to like, be resistant. Bless you. And he said, no. And then he said something that just crushed me at the time. He said, you know what? I think it's sad. He saw something in me that I couldn't see and maybe never saw. You know, something that I was probably looking for someone to see for a lot of my life, and I don't blame it, but looking to be a part of something, or looking to belong, or looking to feel comfortable in my own skin, I never could find that. I never found that. And the more I ran, the farther away I got from it, and I wouldn't realize that. And he said that to me, you know, I'll never forget that, how it made me feel. You know, and it was kind of like the higher power speaking through him to me. And there was a few of those moments, you know, that they came. And the last issue I had with the Kings County justice system was drawn out for a long time. And I had, you know, I had this lawyer that just kept drawing it out and drawing it out, hopefully, I think, giving me a chance. Because he would tell me, he would suggest these ridiculous things to me that I should start doing to show that I was, like, willing to change, or that I was willing, or I deserved a second chance or a third chance or whatever chance I was on. Like, go volunteer. You know, go help be of service in some way. Go to these AA meetings. And do these things that at the time he was suggesting was just absolutely out of the question. He bumped his head if he thought I was going to do something like that. You know, that wasn't in the cards. It just wasn't. And so he drew this court case out for a long time, and I kept going to the same judge over and over. And I think he was getting a little irritated, you know, because he would give me something to do, or he'd give me this chance, and I kept going in front of him, and I hadn't done anything that he said. And it was just kind of like going up and flipping the bird to him every time that I was in front of him. And he wasn't impressed, not at all, and he really wasn't happy to see me that last time. And he said, you know, Mr. Jones, I don't see you wanting to change. I just don't see it in you. Needless to say, and I'll back up just a little bit, the day of that court hearing, you know, I told myself probably about 9 p.m. that I stopped drinking about midnight so I could get some sleep before I went to court. Well, 12 or 9 p.m. went to midnight. Midnight went to 1 in the morning, 2, 3. I'm watching the sun come up. And finally, I'm just like, you know what? I'm just going to blow this off like I did everything else. Just run. My dad passed away, and I still live with my mom, and I remember her asking, don't you have this in your court date today? You know, and you know, my instant response, didn't have to think about it, no, it's next week or something, you know, just blew it off. And my lawyer, you know, calls me up, and he's like, where are you at? And I gave him the same line of bull, you know, and I was resolved to just be full of crap. And I told him, I said, oh, I thought it was next week. And he said, you need to get down here. He's all, either you get down here, they're going to come and get you. Now, and here's where something took over. I got myself cleaned up. I was very, very much intoxicated. I remember trying to pop a bunch of muscle relaxants, some more outside issues, right? And drinking some screw cap, Boone's Farm wine, you know, kind of steady my nerves. And the more that I did that, the looser it got, right? But it wasn't a good loose. It was bad loose for sure, you know. And so I'm in the shower, and I'm weeping. I just lose it because I'm hurting so bad inside, and I couldn't hide it anymore. But helpless, powerless, and comprehensively demoralized, yeah, all that. And it just hit me there because I knew I was going to face something. And I knew that, you know, I had nothing to bring with me. You know? And certainly no reason to hope for any kind of chance again. Not at all. So I arrived down there, you know. I don't have a license, so my mom drives me down to court, you know. And I get there and I look at the, you know, they have the docket up on the wall. And I walk past that and I get in the courtroom. And this is my thought. Man, I'm going to have to sit in court all day now, and everybody else is going to get to go before me. And I'm going to have to just sit here wasting all my time while the rest of these people, you know, get judged, you know. It's like, how inconvenient. I get in there, I'm the only one on the docket. They've been waiting for me for 45 minutes. And my lawyer leans over and goes, do you have any idea what you just did? Now, of course I did. So he told me. He said, you gave them a good extra half hour to decide what they want to do to you. Not for me or how to help you, but what they're going to do to me, you know? And so I'm standing there in front of his honor, and there's three of them. And there's three of them up there. You know, because I drank all that Boone's Farm wine and, you know, popped all that outside Asian. I'm tilting my head so I at least can put one or two of them below the bench, you know, so, and I'm just speaking to one of them. Insane. Just insane. And I drank at the most inopportune moments, you know, before family gatherings, before court hearings, you know. Oh, my God, is it nuts, right? So, say, Mr. Jones, let me get back to this. You haven't shown me, and he's looking at this long history of unmanageability, you know, which is great. My first step was being worse. I didn't even know it. When I needed to find out or you know, cop to the fact my life was unmanageable, it was documented already. It was on paper, you know. And he said this stuff to me. He said, you know what? I'm going to give you a choice. You know, I'm thinking, okay, it's either this much time or this much time. Okay, yeah. He says, you know, I'm gonna give you this 3-year sentence in state prison, whatever that would work out to, probably 18 months or so, whatever. Or I'm gonna give you the option of going to a recovery home. Here's the best part of the insanity. I didn't think about that. Standing there like, you know, like waiting it out on the scale. Now, and the only reason I chose to go to the recovery home was because it was less time before I could have gotten back out on the street and gotten drunk again. Not to mention, you know, I could have gotten drunk in there, you know, so it was perfect. This is working out great. My plan is, you know, gonna drive, gonna fly me into the side of the mountain, but I'm cool. It's all right. And so, you know, he says, you know, when you leave here, go directly to probation, you know, no condition to face my PO. No condition whatsoever, you know. But I go, and he's looking at me, he's just kind of smiling like, I don't even know why I shouldn't just lock you up right now. And he didn't, you know. I believe that it was just part of this process, you know, because the higher power, he had it worked out. You know, thank God he didn't let me in. I would have just messed it up even more. But he had it worked out. So I go to the probation office, check in, which is something I would never do after any other court appearance. But I did it, didn't get locked up. Mom drops me off. I go to the liquor store and just stop by a few other known associates and go back home. And the insanity takes back up and continues for the next 2 months while I'm on this waiting list for this recovery program in heaven. You know, I'm on the waiting list, so it's like, okay, this is, you know, this isn't it, but this is probably it. You know, you tell yourself, I'll justify this, you know, 2 months of the final party, even though it wasn't 2 months of the final party, because I didn't even, you know, had no intention of stopping, no intention of quitting. Didn't know how. But I would get these moments of clarity, and these moments of clarity only proved to show me how crazy and how messed up my life was. And it would drive me back into wanting to get drunk even more, like the cycle. I would see this, see what I wasn't, see what I wasn't, you know, what I couldn't be in my mind. And all of a sudden, I'm back into it. And you get that moment of clarity and go, oh, my God, what am I doing to myself? Oh, this is miserable. Go back to it. And it wouldn't stop. Finally, the guy calls me to come into the next day. No, it gives me a week. That was it. And then it was really on, right? A week before I go into the recovery home. I call him up the day before I'm supposed to go there and ask him, you know, if I can get a little extension on the waiting list so I can stay out a couple more days, because I was out of control. just out of control. You know, and at this point, I was barely leaving my room in my parents' house, except to go out and get what I needed and make sure I had a supply of enough liquid. To keep me occupied for days, there's a couple weeks at a time. And I don't even have to describe to you what kind of conditions I was living in. If the health department had shown up, they probably would have condemned my room alone. They just told them that, you know, if you tear this part of the house down, we'll leave you alone. It was that bad. It was horrible. And there was nothing I could have done about it at that time. And so, needless to say, they had me come in. And I'm in there, sitting there with my intake. And this guy asked me once, "So, when was the last time you had anything to drink? Or anything else?" "Do you have anything to drink?" "No." He asked me this about four times until I finally said, "Yeah." Of course he could tell. And they put me up in detox. Put me up in detox for like 6 days. That 6 days was pretty incredible. You know, going on May 6th, come out on May 12th. You know, the day I claimed was my sobriety day. And you know, I'm surrounded by lots of choices. Because there's plenty of people I knew, plenty of people I didn't know, but could have gotten to know. I always seem to run into the wrong people or the right people, depending on how you look at it, when I was in county. You know, which just made it even more accessible for my disease to continue on, you know, or people that I would find that like to drink and be as miserable as I did, you know. But something changed in the recovery home, and the first 30 days passed, and I was given my first pass. It was an hour and a half pass, and I went home. Now, when I left home, I still had everything there as I left it. Everything, you know, those outside issues and the paraphernalia and the bottles. You know, needless to say, they weren't all empty. And I did something I'd never done before, never attempted to do. I emptied all the bottles and everything else, flushed it down the toilet, put all the bottles and all the paraphernalia in the neighbor's garbage can, because I was still a bit paranoid. The probation came by, saw all that crap in my garbage can, that they might come out and come get me at the recovery home. Sick, you know. And my mom watched me do this. The only person that watched me do this, you know, and I could have very easily turned it on the other way. But at that time, and I recognize it now, you know, I was blessed with this gift of desperation. You know, it was the best place I could have ever ended up in here, because I was broken. Absolutely broken. You know, emotionally, physically, spiritually, you name it. Broken situation Sunday. And when I came back, you know, I shared with the counselors, you know, told them myself. Don't know what got into me, because that was not like my mode of operation, you know. It was like, when I told the truth, I started to get honest. All of a sudden, some of the odds started to happen in this recovery home. I started to, like, separate. Not isolate, mind you, but separate. As I was moving towards in this direction, I couldn't tell you what it was, but it was different from what the majority of people. And, you know, I was told the statistic, like, one out of, you know, or a couple people out of the 24 men that you're in there with are going to make this, you know, and of course, you know, we're sitting around in a group, and I'm going, "Yeah, sorry for all your luck, but I'm going to be that one." You know, that was the ego and the pride. By God's grace, there's about two or three of us, you know, that actually made it out what I consider to be alive. You know, and only a couple that I know that are active in any kind of fellowship, which is good, you know, myself being one of them. And so I get out, and I'm stark raving sober. I mean, I'm not drinking and I'm not getting loaded or doing that other stuff, but I am nuts. Absolutely crazy. That fourth month was, you know, it was great because, you know, I get out and then I'm waiting for them to shut down Main Street in Hanford, you know, to give me the parade. Because I'm sober now, don't you know, you need to recognize this, you know, and come on, key to the city, when's it coming, you know, when's the invitation from the mayor, all this, right? My mom, it was great, you know, it was wonderful, how and on. And she tells me, "What do you want, a medal for something you should have been doing your whole life?" You know. That was our first encounter with that ego deflation that you encounter in the steps when we're working. You know, when we get that little shout of humility, which, you know, keeps us, or keeps me right side, or at least attempts to, you know, on a daily basis. And it was the journey, that's what happened. That is what happened. And I love when I hear people's stories when they talk about in the room. I always listen to that. You know, they talk about this, and they go, and then something happened. And it's that something that I just believe was a miracle for me. I didn't have to wait or not leave until the miracle happened. It was like I was back then in it for me. And I had attended some meetings before of Alcoholics Anonymous. First meeting I attended was because the probation officer came to my, this was before I was in recovery, came to my door, and I looked through the fisheye lens, and I know a little peephole, and I didn't recognize him as friend, and I saw a little star on his chest, and I knew if I opened that door, I was going to jail again, so I didn't do it. And the thing that came to my mind, and as cloudless as it was, this is the other miracle, the thought came to my mind, well, there's a meeting down the street, stupid. He'll never find you there. Go. And that's where I met some really important people in my life. And I, most importantly, I experienced what I believe was the seed of this program, and it was hope. Because I was surrounded in this room by people that were laughing at shit that I did not find funny at the time. And they were happy. And they didn't stink. I did. They didn't, right? You know? Which is funny, I remember my sponsor telling me after a point, and I noticed he'd give me a hug, you know, that wonderful, really uncomfortable stuff when you first get here, and hug on you, and kind of give you the phone number, especially the men. You know, so it's a little strange in ways. You're just like, what do I do with this? And they handed me these books. The first big book that was handed to me, you know, it served as a portal for my bomb, or like that, you know, that first period before I went to treatment. But I remember him telling me, he's like, because he stopped hugging on me all of a sudden, you know? And I was like, I'm hurt. And he told me later on, probably about a year later, like, man, you smell so bad I couldn't get near you. Like, well, that's nice, you know? It's always great to run to people to see you when you first come in and tell you how true and jacked up you were when you got there. And, of course, the pride ego wants to say, I wasn't that bad. Come on, man. Thank you very much, but no thanks. But in this meeting, they were talking about this stuff that they planted the seed of hope. And they did hand me this meeting, or this, it was on a meeting schedule, this list of phone numbers. A man sitting in this room handing me my first big book. You know, and I didn't read it. None of that. Now, when I get out of the recovery home, I've got a sponsor. You know, I know where these meetings are. I start to go because I'm so crazy. I don't know what else to do. I've got to. And I had nothing to lose because I had nothing to, you know, I had nothing when I came out. So it was like nothing to lose. Mom, let me come home. All the Al-Anons were telling me, you're crazy if you let her go home, if you let him go home. And she told me later on that, and I'll never, you know, this is a part of my foundation of faith. And she told me this. She said, you know what? She said, I knew that you knew that if you messed this up, that you were gone. And I think she's still scared to death, but it was that show of faith that she gave me that was really powerful to me. So anyway, you know, I get really involved in the fellowship in Hanford, you know, and I start going to meetings two or three a day, if I could. And I started going out of town, too. I started coming over to this fellowship and going to Fresno and going out to Kalinga and all these other these meetings. And I remember some of the old-timers telling me, you know, I think you might just stay sober if you keep doing this, huh? And I was like, yeah, thanks very much, you know. Thanks for your input, you know. And that something continued to happen, and that miracle continued to happen. You know, three months out of the recovery home, a new meeting, I won't say railroads, but they, you know, I volunteered. They gave me a meeting position, the keys to a church that had stuff in it that very well could have disappeared, you know, if that's what was going to happen, and it didn't. And, you know, that mind of mine was like, they just don't know who I am. But I recognized that faith. They knew exactly who I was, but they still had faith and they're still willing to trust me anyway. Because I couldn't love myself, but they were sure as hell going to teach me. I loved me until I could. You know, that language of the heart again, you know, a lot of it's unspoken, but a lot of it just comes through the contact of other alcoholics. Now, so I get into service. Oh my God, probably the last thing I should have done at that point, because it hasn't ended. You know, and I'm very sarcastic when I say that, because that's probably been one of the best things in my life and in my sobriety has been service. And I have this sponsor, and he takes me through the steps. And I have a close friend who's there along with me for the ride. And this obsession is removed. You know what it talks about in the book about recovering from being recovered from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body? I get it. I really get it. You know, I'm not healed, I'm not well, but I am recovered from that seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. In so much as contingent on the maintenance of my spiritual condition, I'm granted this daily reprieve. Awesome. Absolutely awesome, you know, and so I continued to do what was suggested because I was hurt bad enough to do just about anything that was suggested to stop feeling the way I was feeling. You know, being in service, picking up service commitments, learning what it was to be, to have a commitment, being willing to go any length, to be honest, to start to have people in my life that hold me accountable. People, you know, that I could tell everything to and wouldn't go the other way, you know, but definitely let me know when I wasn't where I needed to be. And I, you know, that fellowship that rises up around us, that talks about in the reading, and experiencing that, and becoming a part of something for the first time in my life. And for all the time that I was running from, running to, right, but never finding it. All of a sudden, you know, the greatest thing that I realized, the greatest thing that ever happened to me, was I took that first drink at the age of 12. Because from there to here, in the last 5.5 years, I couldn't begin to express to you what I've been given from the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And not having put as much in. You know, the returns and the benefits of recovery are just absolutely awesome. You know, I've been able to experience different aspects of service. You know, I had the honor and privilege of serving as District 49's ECM, you know, for the last almost 2 years. And that's taken me to Portland, the Paso, the Pacific Regional AA Service Assembly. It's taken me to Alaska this last March. I've been in Spokane, Washington, to the Pacific Regional Forum, and got to meet some of the trustees, lots of delegates and people. And those are big fancy $5 or $10 names for what we all really are, just alcoholics. And it's really kind of cool. You meet them, you put names or faces to the names, and you shake hands with them, and they make themselves available, and you realize that this is, you know, this is what it's about, the fellowship, Alcoholics Anonymous. And what service in that respect has done for me is taking it from small town of Hanford to a little bigger town by saying, you know, to statewide, to region-wide, you know, going to these processes when you're there with people from Alaska, people from Nevada, Washington, Hawaii, and all this stuff. And then at this regional forum meeting, like the trustee at large who traveled around the world, places like Istanbul, and it was cool, she had hats from every place that she went. So every time she changed the slide, she'd throw a hat on, you know, and talk about it. And talking about where meetings were held in these, you know, these huts. You know, yak down the huts, you know, and they're drinking yak's milk and, you know, all crazy stuff, but it was AA. And it was worldwide alcoholics helping other alcoholics to find that sobriety, to become a part of. What probably touched me the most when I was in Alaska was this. A woman traveled from a small village in the former Soviet Union to come be a part of this process. And you would think, okay, she's right across from the Bering Strait. She's familiar with Alaska, you know, Russia, according to one of our recently unelected officials, right in the backyard of Alaska, right? And that's not funny, too. And so you think, okay, just jump in a boat and do whatever and come across. It doesn't work that way. This woman flew across Asia, across Europe, across the Atlantic Ocean, across the United States, and then up to Alaska. Travel farther than any of us that were there to do one simple thing. Say thank you. See, if it wasn't for fellow alcoholics, like the one sitting in this room, that dedicated themselves to their commitment of service, giving back what was freely given to them, and taking boxes of translated books over the Bering Strait by boat, oddly enough, right? You know, you can go, you just can't leave. You get it. Taking them to the small village, if it wasn't for them, this woman would have never heard the message of Alcoholics Anonymous. She would have never experienced that seed of hope that I experienced in Hanford, California. She had never been introduced to the language of There were about 750 people in that room, and there wasn't a dry eye in the house. Because what she did was amazing. Just coming to say thank you. I'm grateful today for, you know, each and every day that I'm given. And being a part of something and for having this conscious contact with a power that I know greater than myself, my creator, that I've never had my entire life. In the last 5.5 years, I've lived more life than I did since I remember when I was 12. You know, and when I say it's a beautiful day to be sober, it has nothing to do with the weather forecast. But it has everything to do with what's inside of here today. Because today I'm comfortable in this skin. You know? I got to call my mother last night after my supervisor at work told me that I had passed my probation at the work and that I was a regular full-time employee, you know. And my mom wept over the phone and she said, my prayers have been answered. And I said, yeah, mine too. And all that prayer was that 12-year-old little boy inside that was on his knees from that day praying for one thing. Now, all the people who were in my life from that point to this, who were able to see it in me even when I couldn't, especially the people that was in this house I wanted to blow up a lot of time, for dropping that dime on me, thank God for those people. Thank God for these people. My message that I like to carry inside for me is simple. It's one word. It's hope. And I was at this, this, I guess, seminar, whatever you want to call it, training for my work. And there was this woman who spoke, really powerful, right? She shared this one thing, and I'll leave you with this. She shared this, there's this one word that she shared, that I believe it's Swahili, African. And it was awesome because it's one word, but it has like, you know, it's actually translated to this whole deal. And the word was, and I'm gonna jack this up, I know, Ubuntu. Ubuntu. And it translated to, I am because you are. And it reverses itself. You are because I am. I'm just like, man, genius. You know, like, come on. So, you know, I'm a grateful, fortunate, recover from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body alcoholic today, who believes that the solution is in that big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, and that the steps were worked first in order for that book to come about, and that book coming about in that first 164 pages, for me, that's the real deal. That's the real deal. So, thanks for listening. And thank you.
Just feeling like how angry I was. shit, little comments, little things like that.